Okay. Number 84, it's page 406, Education. This is the essay on education, but of course, he has this volume, this is collected writings, this is only essays on education, this whole volume, and there's other ones, really. Like, pretty clear that there's other ones. But, okay, so I'm gonna try and go fast, because like, fit off, whatever we can fit in. There's so many other things I also want to do, but this one for sure we want to do, so, okay. If, it's page 406 in the heart. If the highest of blessings is without question the bestowal of blessing, we learned about that. What is the highest bracha you could receive? Is to be someone who gives bracha to others. Veheye bracha, right? If the highest of blessings is without question the bestowal of blessing, can there be a higher blessing than to receive a being which itself poor in everything must derive from your love everything which the world can offer it, which through your love must become whatever it is destined to be in life? So if I have chills just reading it. If the biggest bracha that Hashem gives us is the ability to give to someone else, then can there be any bracha greater than Hashem entrusting you with somebody who's so completely poor, they have nothing at all, right? No clothes, no food. They have no ability of their own to take care of themselves. And they are completely dependent on you from your love to just give to them. That would be the greatest bracha, right? If the opportunity to give to someone is the biggest bracha Hashem gives us, then the biggest example of that is if he entrusts you with someone who is completely reliant on your care. That would be having a child. Such is the blessing which heaven bestows on you when it gives you a child. Okay, so realize what he just did. It's not just a nice statement that having a child is a big bracha. It is. He's trying to frame in our mind, how do we feel about having children? Is it that our friends are having children at a certain age, and so you also want to have children, and then you know, Rahman al-Islam, people have to wait a while to have children and other people haven't it, right? They're walking with the strollers and with the, and they don't have it. That's not the focus. The focus is the opportunity to give. If that's how you feel, is that I am going to give to this little person everything he needs, not only for his life in this moment, but what his life will become, that's the attitude that you have about the child, then that's going to shape and affect everything that you then do for the child and how you feel about it when they wake you up every hour or two for months at a time. How do you feel about it? Is it, oh, I'm so grateful? It doesn't mean you kick yourself if when you're very sleep deprived, you didn't feel this way, but it's very different if when you're, you know, my last child is 10 years younger than the one before. So I wasn't really expecting to have the opportunity to have another baby by then. You know, 10 years, like a long time. Whatever, Baruch Hashem, I was blessed with a big family. Like, it's not something to feel bad about. But with this one, it was so different in that every time she woke me up, even though I was really tired, I was so happy to have someone to get up for. It's just a different feeling inside if you're feeling that you're so grateful to be able to give. That's already. Look well at the little creature which is just awakened into being as yours. It's just awakened into being as yours. The child existed before, as a neshama, it existed before, but it wasn't awake and involved with the world until it was born as yours. Does no voice whisper to you what it expects of you? And the answer is, of course it does. It doesn't just whisper what it expects of you. I think he means your inner voice, not so much the baby's voice. That somehow deep within you already have, you understand what you need to provide. It has no claim on you for what could or can it do for you. The baby doesn't have a right to expect or demand anything of you. This is also a piece of understanding it. Very easy to get into that. Since the child is so dependent on us, then therefore, like, it's dangerous to allow a child to think that it has the right to demand it of you. Of course, that starts at a very young age. That's not it. It's not that. It's everything you're doing for the child is not because the child has the right to expect it of you. And you don't owe it to the child because of, like, you know, in the normal course of human affairs, someone does for someone else. If they do a lot for you, you feel that you should reciprocate to them. That would be fair or just, right? The child isn't, what could or can it do for you? It's not that. It's not that it has a right to demand from you. And you are to be everything to it. You have to provide everything for this child, not out of justice, but out of love. You have to understand that the reason you're doing it is not because the child has a right to it, but because Hashem really is demanding it of you that you love it. It's a little bit different. Your debt and your obligation is not to your child. Your debt and your obligation is to Hashem. That's different. But by the way, that will make you a much happier mommy. Because if you have more than one child, both demanding something of you, maybe something just important to them, but not really deeply important, or maybe something really important, right? Like, I don't know. I once had two kids in the hospital at the same time. Just now I have two parents in the hospital at the same time. That's different. I once had two kids in the hospital at the same time. Fortunately, they were in the same hospital. It made it much less complicated. But let's say they were in different hospitals. You're going to feel torn, right? Haven't you? But you have to realize the obligation is to Hashem. So I have to figure out what Hashem wants me to do. Whenever in life you have competing obligations demanding you, you start to fall to pieces. Because how could you do everything? Whatever it is you do, you're going to be messing something else up, right? You can't be two places at once. The one thing that could keep you centered and focused and able to function is to realize that you're top obligation is to Hashem, and everything else flows from that obligation to Hashem. And from that, then you can figure out what's your priorities, what does he want you to do, and you could live with yourself with whatever you didn't do. Yeah? Okay. So here, we're not talking about multiple kids. Sorry?
And you have to go for that once?
Sometimes you can. Sometimes you literally can't be two places at once. What could you do?
You don't feel bad about
it? You're not going to feel guilty about it, and you didn't fail because of it. Yeah? You are human. You can only do as much as you could do. You make every effort. And sometimes Hashem gives you siyata. It's trying to do more than you think is humanly possible. Could be. But you have to just do what you can. And if you're going to, sometimes there will be times in your life where you can't do everything. And you have to remind yourself that the obligation is to Hashem. Your obligations to others are really your obligation to Hashem. So therefore, what is it Hashem wants you to do? The first place you look is the halacha. Because that's where he told us what he wants us to do for others, among other things. Yeah? So you have to ask a Rav to tell you how to paskin it. Paskining is to take the competing demands within the halacha and understand what will trump what. Sometimes you have to get an etzah. Sometimes you have to look in your side yourself. Whatever, there's different, that's different, a whole different topic. Okay. But just understand, sometimes this idea, the baby, it has no claim on you. What could or can it do for you? And you are to be everything for it. This doesn't release you from an obligation. It's a much stronger obligation. If you have a debt to somebody because they did to you and now you owe them, once you repay the debt, now you don't owe them anything. Over here we're saying it's not that you owe the child. You owe Hashem to take care of that child. That's a much more firm commitment, actually. A more lasting commitment. You are to be everything to it, not out of justice, but out of love, which is your highest vocation. Vocation is like your job and mission. Your highest job and mission is love. We know that, right? Baruch Hashem, we have a lot of background to prepare us for this essay. It's a good thing because we have 35 minutes to learn all about education, which is nothing other than being a blessing to all around you. So what does it mean to function out of love, to do out of love? It has to come into deeds, of course. So what does it mean to love? Some say, oh, I love the whole world and everything. So it's not what it means. Yeah? It means be a blessing to all around you. Right? That was also the Veheye Bracha. But you must realize all the holiness, the blissfulness, the loftiness of this vocation. You must feel how the name Father or Mother consecrates you as a high priest. It makes you a Kohen Gadol. Do you remember that? The Atah Tetzaveh, commentary on Ve'atah Tetzaveh, Laha'alos Ner Tamid? Right? He's learning out the role of the parent as an educator from the role of the Kohen Gadol. You must feel how the name Father consecrates you as a high priest in order that you may fully and earnestly justify this appellation, that means this name, this title, in holiness and joy. The child is not there for you. These are very important principles of parenting, underlying, not the decision making, yeah, but if you're seeing it the right way, it helps you make decisions the right way. The child is not there for you, but you are there for the child. Okay, now this you think could lead to spoiling. Don't worry, he's not known for a spoiling attitude. But it's important to realize that. Because if the child is there for you and the child is angry at you or resents you or is mad at you, it's going to be mad at them, right? Because they hurt your feelings. But you don't want to admit that, so you're going to be mad at them because they should do better than that. They should respect you. Torah says the child should respect you. The child's not there for you. They have an obligation to respect you. That's between them and Hashem. That's actually not between them and you. In the same way that your duty to care for them is not between you and them. It's between you and Hashem. Which means that no matter how difficult they are, you could take a step back and say, look, that is between the two of us. But what does Hashem want me to do over here? How do I help them? How do I keep helping them? The child is not there for you, but you are there for the child. That is the lesson which the obligation devolving on you to redeem your firstborn should impress on your soul. And then he refers you to a different essay so you could see that concept more. Meaning, he's saying also is that the mitzvah of the pidyon bechor, of pidyon haben, since it's like the first child, that would be like the Torah telling you what's the first thing you would think of when you become a parent. Yeah, so that's also an interesting one. But we're only going to cover a little teeny fraction. And that is the first feeling that is expected of you, for therein lies the blessing. You know, the word Bechar also has the same letters as the word Baruch. Okay. Therein lies the blessing. Possessed of this feeling, you will not seek to derive the greatest possible advantage for yourself from the child. So you're not trying to get your kid to become a doctor, a lawyer, a rav, to gratify your pride, right? Or to look cute or to behave nicely because it's so embarrassing if they don't, because that would be deriving advantage to yourself. You will not seek to derive the greatest possible advantage for yourself from the child. You will not want to calculate whether and with what the child will one day repay all the care which you bestow on him. Someday, when I'm old, they'll take care of me. Is that why you had kids? They'll take over your business? I don't know, like what? For you are there for him. Your orientation as a parent is, what can I do for the child? That's your orientation as a parent. And precisely, I just want to stop for a second. Do you realize that our first understanding, not our first understanding, our first beginning of relating to Hashem in a relationship with Hashem begins with our relationship with our parents. The beginning of our understanding of how Hashem cares for us is how our parents care for us. Then we have to grow even beyond that, because Hashem is much greater than our parents, no matter how great your parents are. Hashem is greater than that and more perfect than that. And never, split up with competing obligations and never messes up and never, okay. Rabbi Orlowitz told me he never met someone who has a problem with Hashem that doesn't have that problem already from their children, from their parents. It comes from there. It doesn't come from, yeah. So if your children grow up knowing that you are not trying to get something from them, you're only thinking about what you can do that will be best for them to the best of your abilities, look what a head start that gives them. In trusting that what Hashem is doing for them is for bracha and to help them and support them, even if it's something painful. Right? Because that's their baseline now. You are there for him, and precisely in this impossibility of repayment on the part of the child lies the crowning blessing of being a father. When you're younger in school and you learn, what's chesed shel emes? Levayas hames. Right? Because they can do nothing back for you. Well, if you raise a child and for decades you're caring for them and the whole time you're assuming that it's you are there to do for them, not them to do for you, isn't that also a type of chesed shel emes? Right? It's not death, Baruch Hashem, it's life. But it's caring for someone without expecting them to do for you. That's the basis of it. It's pure chesed. This is the crowning blessing of being a father. Let's say a parent. The crowning blessing of being a parent. For verily, that means in truth, if the opportunity of being able to devote yourself wholly to the welfare of a human being is not the height of your happiness, if giving is not incomparably more blessed to you than receiving, then you ought never to have been a father. That's scary. That's a little scary. Okay, but hopefully you're able to appreciate that the more you're giving and the more real the giving is and selfless the giving is, the more blessed you are, then you are very well equipped to be a father. In this high priestly frame of mind, you come before God. Isn't that interesting? That's the mindset of being a Kohen Gadol. Isn't that interesting? Purely service. It could be it's based on, I heard a shir from Rabbi Eisman, and he pointed out that the avoda of the Levium is described, I think it's Parshas Kisisa, I'm not sure, like Visarisa, something like that. The Lashon of Sar, like Sarara. Yeah, Sarara is like dominance. A sar is an officer or a prince, right? But it also means to serve. It's related to the word sherut. So over there, it's being used to say that they should serve. And they right? In the Beis HaMikdash. So he says that's because the service of that kind of public service is really that kind of, we treat a Kohen as if he's royal. Yeah, and with all this honor, but their role is to serve, not to feel that they're above everyone, but to feel that they're in service of everyone. Okay, so this is the high priestly frame of mind. You come before God and ask, to what end has he placed such a sacred object as a human soul in your hand? What he desires you to be to it? Of course, as a parent, isn't your first question going to be, Hashem, what do you want me to do with this little tiny bundle of dependence? What did you want me to provide for it? His voice comes back to you in the word of his servant. If you want to know what Hashem is telling you, go look at his words that he told you. That's Torah. Yeah? You have to understand, when we want to know, what does Hashem want from me? Why doesn't he tell me? Well, maybe he told you. We have his words, yeah? The words of Moshe, not the words of Moshe, the words of Hashem that Moshe told us. The law which Moses has commanded us, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, is the inheritance which the father is to transmit to his child. He's now translating Morasha. It's something you receive, but the purpose of receiving it is to hand it forward. Not to receive it, to bequeath it. Morasha, not Yerusha. Morasha, something you bequeath, kehila, to his child in the community of Jacob. For that purpose, it was given to you. The Torah was spelled out to you so that you could spell it out to your children. You could teach it. Okay, we're going to jump ahead now to the next paragraph. It's all worthwhile, but what can we do? Chanoch lana'ar al pi darko. Educate a child according to his path. Equip and train up your child according to the requirements of his future path in life. You hear the taich there? Alpi darko means his path. You need to chanoch. Remember that was in the Rashi, that lechanech is to initiate somebody into the role which they are destined to have to stand in. So you have to give them what that's, and we learn it from Vayarek Eschanichov. He equipped his students. He gave them the tools for the war. That was Avram going to fight Sodom. He gave them the tools they needed. Chanoch lanar al pi darko is equip and train your child. Give him the tools and skills he needs according to the requirements of his derech, of his future path in life. This is the golden rule of education which our law sets before us. Equip and train your child early for that which he is to practice when he has outgrown your guidance. Gam ki yazkin lo yasur mimenu. In other words, he's going to stay on this path because this is the path Hashem is sending him to. So he has to be prepared for it even when you are not there to give it to him. You remember that was also in Ve'ata Tetzaveh. that the goal of the parent is to become obsolete or superfluous, right? Because that's the natural way that things should be, that they should be able to go out on their own. Equip the child by providing it amply with the means which its future activity will require. What is it going to have to do and be as an adult, as a Jew? You have to give them what they need. Train it by making it carry out already in its narrow circle and under your supervision the duties which await it when it becomes independent. This is true for what we would call like mundane or secular things as much as in Torah things. You let children do as much as you can safely let them do so they can make mistakes when they are small and the consequences are manageable. Falling off a tricycle is a lot less lethal than crashing a car. It's good to start at a young age, to cook something that doesn't, you know, and if it burns, right? Little by little, they'll learn. They need practice. You have to do it in order to be able to do it. So train them by letting them carry out in its narrow circle, so in smaller things first, and in things within the home first, and gradually bigger and bigger. But at the beginning, it's under your supervision. So the goal is to let a child become independent over time. So you want to give them first to do it while you're really close helping, and then to step back, let them make some mistakes. It's okay while you're still there to help keep the consequences at a manageable level and not lethal, so that they will have the skills and tools they need as they get older. So that it does not just begin to live when it enters life. A child who's 20 years old and now they're going to have to learn how to cook and do laundry and how to talk to other people pleasantly because you never made them do it inside the house, right? And how to dress themselves and how to... Did you ever read The Secret Garden? Is that The Secret Garden? Right? Mary, and she comes and she holds her hands out and the maid is like, what's your problem? She's like, well, I never dressed myself. But like, doesn't thou know to dress thyself, right? Like, you can't put... You're not doing someone a favor by caring for them in such a way as to make them dependent on you, then they do that, because that's not called education. Educating is equipping them with the tools to do it themselves. Okay, so one point I just want to like really emphasize is the question you ask yourself when you're not sure, what's the way to handle this, is what will better equip this child? It's a very helpful question. So that it does not just begin to live when it enters life, but continues in wider circles and in more serious affairs what it has begun under your eyes. Okay, so this brings me, I'm going to make the point and I'm going to, okay, this just to take home and look at, just because he's making the point, but you can find it in plenty of other places, but it's a nice point. This is a point that I've heard. We heard it from Rav Naftali Kaplan. We heard it from Rav Orlowick, which is the goal of chinuch is to equip and prepare the child. That means that if there is something dangerous to a child, your question as a parent is, what will best equip the child for the long run? So sometimes you can insulate your child. Okay, so the simple example, although controversial perhaps, is there's measles going around, let's say. What will better equip the child in the long term? Is it to protect them by insulating them, or to protect them by inoculating or immunizing them? Okay. So the rule of thumb is this. If you are able to ensure that the child will, for the long term, be able to stay insulated, then that is better. Don't expose them to something dangerous that could hurt them. But if you cannot guarantee that the child over the long term can remain insulated, you must immunize them. You must inoculate them and give them small and supervised exposure to that challenge or danger in order to train them in the skills with how to cope with that danger. That is spiritual and physical.
Does that count, like, let's say speaking about the danger instead of instead of actually exposing your child to what it is, but
not, it's probably not enough. It might be enough at one phase. When they're little, you might be able to keep them sheltered. And then at some age, you're going to talk about it. And then another, they must put it into practice or they're not equipped. You don't have a skill until you've learned to use it.
You're saying that all families, let's say fit movie, without the friend.
Right.
So you're saying that families should be showing their children movies?
Well, we could think it through for a minute. At least we could think through what the question would be, how you would think about the question. You have to come up with the answer. So maybe you can ensure that your child will not be exposed to movies for the long term. It could be. By the way, I think that nowadays, in a way, that question is easier. Because when I was young, you went to movie theater to see a movie. I mean, there was TV and there was movies. There was no such thing that could be in the house, movies. I mean, I guess there were people who had like video players and could go to like a store and rent a video and stick it in the machine. That was a problem, even in those days. Actually, that was a problem, okay. But if you didn't have the equipment in the house, then the only way the child would do it is by sneaking out and doing it, which is wrong, and it could be, okay. But nowadays, it's so obvious that exposure to media is all over the place. I mean, yes, it's movies, but like there's little tiny short movies, like what they show you on an airplane about buckling up. I was on one airline, not recently. Where just the movie about like the oxygen masks and whatever was like not really so nice, and you couldn't avoid it. If you want to go to Eretz Yisrael, your kid's going to be on a plane and there's 350 other people on that plane all watching who knows what. It's very difficult to keep their eyes off of it, so now what are you going to do? I'm not sure that you can completely insulate your child from seeing. Not in Los Angeles now, they took that away, but a lot of cities they still have moving digital billboards. Or inside of like malls or something like that. I mean, it's difficult to ensure your child will never be exposed. So then the question is, how can I prepare them so that they know what to do when it is in front of them? How am I going to teach this child in such a way that they will be able to decide for themselves not to watch? Or if it's there, to decide not to look? Because deciding not to look is easier said than done. Do you ever sit on an airplane and the people around you have videos on? Your eyes naturally go to what's moving, and it's much brighter than even the real world around you. So there's some kind of skill required there to not look. It's really very difficult. You end up seeing stuff you really didn't want to see just because you were walking to the bathroom and back. What are you supposed to do, not go to the bathroom for 15 hours? Like, right? Like, you're going to have some kind of tool to deal with it. So one tool is to be able to have self-discipline and say, I'm not going to. Another is, what if you do see something you don't want that's wrong to see? Then what do? Right? Because it was this little glimpse. So maybe you have to have some tool for that, mental tools for that, right? Well, is there a tshuva I need to do? Do I daven to Hashem? Do I look at something else? Right? What do I do about the fact that I saw something like that I wasn't protected from it? Can I at least tear myself away from it if I shouldn't see it? That's also hard to do, right? Once you saw it, now what do you do? Do I sit down in my seat? Maybe I should turn on that flight map. I would rather have nothing on because that's going to distract me. I was going to learn. And now this map is on. But maybe if the map is on, I will go to that. I won't keep getting pulled into something else. That's also a type of tool or skill. There's some kind of tools and skills that are required to deal with that problem because we can't ensure that our children won't be exposed for the long run. We do have to give them some kind of tool. That doesn't mean you have to have videos in your house. Right? But it means you have, maybe you want to give them the example of not having it in the house. But you can't just not talk about. So what happens when you're out somewhere? You're in a waiting room. The place I go to get my blood drawn always has the TV on in the waiting room. So maybe you sit underneath it so at least your eye doesn't go to it. It's hard to see it if it's over your head, but you're still hearing it. So now what do you do? Right? This is important tools for life. Really important. Why should your child have to figure that out on their own? Without any help from their parents.
That's not exposing your child going to the waiting room for.
That's not called exposing them. They're getting exposed.
Right. It's not called bringing something into your home to expose.
I didn't say you bring it into the home. What I said is, if you can't ensure that they will stay insulated, you have an obligation to immunize. That means that since that's the world we live in, let's say as a parent, you could say, I'm going to figure out how not to. I'm going to have this nurse who comes to the house and does the blood tests. so we never have to see it. But could your child, after they're out of your care, not have to ever see it? Is because it's only because you, or maybe you say, I'll just run in and out and my child won't see, right? But then you never taught them what to do about it now. You protected them from it. You kept them home anytime you went somewhere where there could be a TV on, and now they don't know what to do. I'm not saying it has to be in your home. I'm saying you have to equip them. You have to give them tools. It's not fair. They should have to learn that by themselves. Through trial and error? That's how they're going to learn?
But you can...
What if the first time they ever saw... I don't know. Can you? If you can, then good.
Speak to them. Like in this situation...
I don't know. I'm not sure talking to a kid by itself gives them a tool or a skill.
What's the difference?
It gives them a framework.
Like
the same way, when you learn something, until you practice it with your hands, it's not fully integrated. Much better they should learn it in an environment where the consequences are less, just like cooking or driving. They should learn it in a controlled environment where you can give them the tools and the practices they need when it's not life-threatening. It's much better. It is much better for them. You don't have to use me as your... This, but what I'm telling you is this principle. How you will apply it as things come up in life, at least you'll be aware there's such an idea, and then you question and you go to a Rav, discuss it with your husband, and you'll figure out what you need to do. But it's very good to be aware that this is an issue. Okay, so I brought you a piece from, this is from the Collected Writings, Volume 7 on Education. We're just going to do a few lines. On page 413, you see I bracketed a little thing. The goal of all child rearing should be, do you see where I bracketed it? Mm-hmm. Should be to train the child for his future unsupervised independent life in an adult world. Okay, now on page 415, I'm going to have to run through this. It is not enough to teach our children to love and perform their duties as Jews within the home and the family among carefully chosen like-minded companions. You can only function in life now among other very from people. Because they're not going to be always insulated from people who aren't like-minded. This was true 200 years ago, and it's still true. It hasn't changed yet. It is wrong to keep them ignorant of the present-day differences between the world outside and the Jewish way of life, or to teach them regarding the un-Jewish elements in the Jewish world as polluting infectious agents to be avoided at all costs. If you just teach them avoid, 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 they will not be prepared. I know it. Look, if you can, you can. The problem is that these are issues where you can't. We asked a Shaila, I'm not going to name names because that's not fair. A Shaila is a Shaila and it's defined. We wanted to know when our children were tiny, should we have any non-Jewish books in the home? Or only Jewish books in the home? And we thought probably only Jewish books is better, is a healthier situation for our children. Recognizing, especially 30 years ago, that this was a narrower, there's not going to be as many books to choose from. And we asked someone who is a very, very great Baal Eitza, and he told us, you should have them and you should teach your child how to relate to the outside world from within the safety of your home. I didn't know this other thing. So he said, so you read, if you read non-Jewish books with your children and you talk about it with them, now they learn how to deal. Now, that doesn't mean just everything goes, right? There are ideas that you do want to insulate children from. Who says they ever have to deal with them? There are also things that are better not to know till you're a certain age, and then is the right time to learn about them. That's okay too, right? You have to know when, at what point, when is the child strong enough to introduce to them? Not every shot does a baby get in the hospital when they're born. Some things wait till you're 1 year old or 3 months old or 2 years old, right? You have to be ready. You have to be built up. You have to have the strength for it. Yeah, but if you never teach them, you are doing a disservice because your goal as the parent, your job is chanoch lenar al pi darko. Okay. Remember that our children will not remain forever under the sheltering wings of our parental care. Sooner or later, they will inevitably have contacts and associations with their un-Jewish brethren in the Jewish world, meaning non-religious Jews. If in this alien environment they are to remain true to the traditions and the way of life in which they were raised at the home of their parents, if we want them to continue to perform their duties as Jews with calm, unchanging determination, regardless of the dangerous influences, and even more dangerous, the ridicule and derision they may encounter, Indeed, if the contrast they note between their own way of life and that of the others will only make them love and practice their sacred Jewish heritage with even greater enthusiasm than before, then we must prepare them at an early age to meet this conflict and pass this test. We must train them to preserve their Jewish views and to persevere in their Jewish way of life, precisely when they associate with individuals whose attitude and way of life are un-Jewish. Does that mean you go around all the time, you know, filling your home with everybody who's not Jewish or un-Jewish? No, of course not. You want them to have that their baseline of what is normal is a Jewish life. But does that mean that you would never permit somebody into your home? There are no people like this. Someone would come in their home wearing a knitted yarmulke. They would want them to maybe put on a black yarmulke. The kids shouldn't see, you know, whatever. They'll lose respect for them. You know, maybe it's better you should teach your child how they should relate to someone with a different kind of yarmulke, or how they could relate to someone who doesn't have a yarmulke. You understand what I'm saying? If you are having this person, like, okay. We must train our children by diligent practice to be able to stand up against ridicule and wisecracks. Okay, so that might mean that you let your child come along with you to things. Because the more they're part of regular life, the more they're seeing how you deal with regular life. And that gives them the practice to learn how to do things. We must train them so that they may be able to draw upon the deep wellsprings of Jewish awareness and their own sound judgment based on true Jewish knowledge in order to obtain the armor of determination and, if need be, the naked weapons of truth and clarity. I mean, not just to defend themselves, but sometimes even to be able to defend themselves, like, aggressively, from which frivolity and shallowness will beat a hasty retreat. Okay, I'm not going to keep going here because we need to go on, but this is not a short essay, this one, but just to understand, this is the point. Okay, next page, page 408. I'm just going to do the first sentence, not the breakdown. The resources which the child requires for living as an Israelite are, one, physical powers. In other words, we have to give our children the skills and resources. What are they? One, physical powers. They have to have strong bodies to the best that we can provide that for them. That means nutrition, exercise, health, right? Two, mental powers. And three, the ability to earn and maintain himself. This is what the child needs in order to be able to continue as an adult, even without you. Then he basically spells out not only what these ideas mean, but what the curriculum is that you need to educate a child so that they will be prepared. And we're going to skip that, but it's very worthwhile. Okay, now we're going to go to page 412. I just want to point out one line in the previous one. Okay, so we're going to start on paragraph 554, but at the end of 553, he points out, we have tried to trace the general course for boys. The same, however, holds true for girls. And then he has like one line explaining what the difference would be in training a girl over training a boy. It's very interesting. He doesn't see that there's a big difference in how you need to educate a boy and a girl, which is very unusual in those days. Nowadays, we see it as normal, of course. Everyone has to know Torah. Everyone has to know mitzvot. Like what? To know how to live. But it was a little bit unusual at the time. To equip the boy, and obviously he means the child, he just pointed out, it's basically the same up training with a few differences. To equip the boy with physical strength and with knowledge is but half a step to preparing him for his future course in life. Practice is required to complete it. Before the duty has devolved on him, as soon as he knows about it, and even earlier, begin to practice your child, both in the home and outside, in the duties which await him. And do not give up your guidance, nay, redouble it when the time for performing the duty arrives. In other words, you don't start educating a child when they're 13. You start when they're much younger and habituate them. Seek at an early stage to influence his inner life. And here he starts, and this is what I was hoping we'd get up to this last week, but then it turned out to be Lag BaOmer, and I was away, and then this week we could do this, so we won't. He talks about at different stages and ages what kind of the focus of your education is on. So with the littlest ones, it's habituate him early to obedience. It's important from the very beginning that a child know to sacrifice his own satisfaction and enjoyment for something higher. Sometimes, no, but it's for a good reason. And he says elsewhere in his writings on education that we don't need to add more no's. The Torah has given us what we require, what is permitted and what isn't. Only say no when it is necessary for the health, either physical or spiritual or emotional, of the child. If it is necessary for their well-being, you say no. If not, you shouldn't just, you know, these like you throw out a random no because like you're overwhelmed or something. No. But if you say no, you must stick with it. That doesn't mean that if they say, wait, could we talk about it? And maybe there's like more could be said or something you didn't know or some other. Could be a reasonable person, yeah? But that has to do with obedience and having a higher, right? Understanding that some things are no. And if they're no, then they're really no. You don't keep pushing against that. On the other hand, from the parent's point of view, only say no if it's not healthy for their development, physical, emotional, or spiritual. Don't say no. You don't need to add more. We have our mitzvahs already. Like, it's not. Okay, so we'll have to stop here. It's been wonderful. And thank you. Thank you all. Like, it's amazing that you took the time out of like very busy and really exciting time. I know, I'm ready to keep on going.
He's so confused.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You'll have to keep reading. We're not finished. We're in the middle. What could you do? It's always the middle. That's the problem. But isn't it nice each time you start a new one that it's easier because you know so much from other ones?
Yeah.
Right? It's like the hardest one is the first. The hardest essay is the first. And each one is building and building no matter what order you do them in. That's Torah, right? The more you know, the more you understand, and the more it builds. Anyway, but these points, even if we only touch like the tiny beginning of the surface of just what Rav Hirsch teaches about education, it's worthwhile, it's helpful to understanding. Like, why am I here? It's a whole way of thinking about parenting or any kind of education, right? Not only parenting, any kind of teaching. I am here, my question is, what is good for this child? And the definition of good is not what makes this child happy. Good is what will best equip him for his long-term life. That's very important. This country seeks to teach us that less stress equals good. More comfort equals good. Treat yourself or treat someone else equals good. That is not the definition of good. I'm not saying that's bad by itself, but that is not what goodness is. Right? The highest goodness is being able to give. So if, as a parent, you really want your children to be happy, it doesn't come by making them feel happy constantly. The way to train a child to have a truly happy life in this world and the next is to equip them to do Torah and mitzvos properly. And that also requires being able to support themselves and all those things, because like, you gotta eat, right? So this is, when I say, what is what's good for this child? It's a whole different way of thinking about it. And also makes you a more confident parent, and also not so easily like, because like kids don't always appreciate it at every moment, you know? That's okay. It's all right. It's fine. Because you are doing it for them. That's okay. All right. Shav bracha natzlach. That's so exciting.